Sure, start. Today is February the 19th, 2009.
It's March, actually.
Oh, I do this at the beginning of every interview. I get part of the date wrong. It is March the 19th, 2009. And I leave all my mistakes on the tape, so it doesn't matter.
Okay.
And Nancy Perozzo, B. Cherniak, and we are interviewing Mr. Sid Kasner. And we'll start the interview by asking you to give a brief introduction to your connection to the grain trade.
Well, I came to the grain trade in 1972. I was working in Ottawa with Weights and Measures, and the Canadian Grain Commission were reorganizing to meet the requirements that were coming in the near future. For example, the grain industry, the elevators in Thunder Bay and the rest of Canada, the terminal and transfer elevator system, were putting in automatic electronic scales. And not only that, the grain trade was facing changing from the imperial system of weights and measures to the metric system. So that brought about challenges which the commission realized they, with the staff they had, they weren't fully capable of meeting these challenges. So they, and in particular for the weighing side of the Canadian Grain Commission, some key people had retired, and they brought in, the commission brought in, for the weighing side of things, they brought in a person from, I believe, CNR. They seconded a man by the name of Jim Harris. And under Jim's leadership and Mr. Baxter's leadership, they staffed the weighing division with people from other parts of the government, such as myself, and later on, Mr. John Swanson, who passed away about 20 years ago. When I first came to the commission, they gave me the responsibility for audits and scales. Auditing is a big part of the function of the Canadian Grain Commission, and the idea in an audit is to, it is a requirement of the Canada Grain Act to periodically establish the amount of grain in an elevator, in a terminal elevator or a transfer elevator. They compare the actual quantity of the grain to the outstanding elevator receipts. On the elevator receipt, of course, they state the type and the grade and the quantity of grain that should be in the elevator. So you make a physical, you weigh over the grain, and that amount is compared to the actual paper stock. So that's one of the functions. And then, of course, the weighing side, the weighing division, as it was called, is responsible for the accuracy of the scales. There's a fairly intense system in order to maintain the accuracy of the scales. And one important part of this whole thing, which is kind of always missed by anybody who wants to describe it, is the traceability of the actual scales and their weights to the international standards of weights and measures. And by that, to further explain that, the system of weights and measures in the world is based on an international kilogram, which is housed in France. Canada has a replica of that international kilogram, which is housed by, which is maintained by the National Research Council in Ottawa. All of our weights that we use to calibrate scales in Canada are traceable to that international, to that replica of the international kilogram. The international, and periodically our replica, Canada's replica, and all replicas for other countries in the world are compared against the international standard to determine their accuracy. So, and the reason that's so important for the Canadian grain trade is because Canada signs, for each cargo of grain sold, Canada signs a certificate attesting to the weight and to the grade. So if you're not positively sure about the accuracy of your weighing system, you really are signing a document which really isn't valid. So that's why the weighing part of this, of the Canadian Grain Commission function, is very important to the industry.
Can I ask, how do you do that, in fact, to make sure that those scales are accurate?
Well, in your father's time and in my time, each one of the elevators are equipped with standard weights of each one of these blocks of weight is probably 1,000 pounds or 500 kilograms, and they're actually set on each corner. You can imagine the scale. These are huge, huge hoppers. And underneath the hopper, we're talking now about when the scales have been converted from a mechanical system with levers. We're now talking about scales that are mounted on electronic devices called load cells. And from the bottom of these load cells, you can imagine as the weight comes into the hopper, it strains the load cell, and that difference electronic signal is then translated into a number that you can read on an electronic readout, in order to simplify the whole discussion. Well, you then can put hang from those load cells, you can hang a known standard of weight on each corner, because they're mounted on four corners, and that actual amount that you add, the standard weight, should read out on, should be evident on the electronic readout within a certain tolerance. Mm-hmm. So, and then you keep doing that, you keep adding more grain into the hopper, add on the standards to see if the difference is read accurately, and you work up to the capacity, full capacity of the scale. And that's a standard practice for all of these very large scales that are used in other industries as well. So you can imagine it works. I mean, if you have a bathroom scale that you step on, and they're now electronic, and a readout comes, and there you are. That morning you decide, well, I'm 20 pounds heavy. So you know that for the next 2 weeks you're not going to be eating well.
So it was around the 1970s that the conversion went from mechanical to electronic.
Yeah, it was around 1970, and it happened slowly. When I left in 1993, I believe it's accurate to say that all of the scales in Thunder Bay were converted to electronic scales, save for a few houses, a few elevators that weren't doing very much. For the transfer elevator system, I can't vouch for that, but I think very few of them were converted to electronic scales. And as you probably know, there aren't too many of those transfer elevators that are actually in business today. And even at Thunder Bay, I'm sure, I don't know the actual numbers, but I'm told only four of the elevators are actually working.
Nancy, you'd know more about that.
I think there's still some holdover from buyout and of Saskpool.
Oh yeah.
And but they're on stream for coming off stream.
Yeah.
So I think you're pretty accurate there. Count in my head.
Yeah, and the reason for that, of course, is our traditional markets have moved more towards Asia rather than Europe. So it's natural that the grain flow go west to Vancouver.
Actually, there'd be six. There would be six still working.
Six still working.
Cargill, Mission.
Yeah.
Viterra, P&H, and Richardson.
P&H is still working.
And Canada Malting.
Well, Canada Malt is but it wasn't. It's not a terminal elevator.
Okay.
So they handle malt. So anyway, that was one of the reasons that the commission saw fit to change their direction as far as staffing the weighing division. They wanted more technical expertise in order to handle this. And then a couple of years later, along came Metric. And I'm almost sure that, we're not, even now, so many years later, people still think in bushels. So, but the scales in the elevators all weigh in the metric system, and that's the way it is. But I talk to the farming community often, and they still talk about their trucks holding so many bushels of grain, which is probably normal. That's the way they think, and I suppose that's the way it should be. But also another function I'll discuss a bit of the function of the actual function of the weighing of grain, because due to the Canada Grain Act, the commission is charged with weighing all the grain that is unloaded in a terminal elevator, and it comes in by covered hopper car. Now, back in the 60s and before the 60s, it was mostly boxcars. It was all boxcars. But in the 70s, there was the introduction of the covered hopper car, which had an effect on the elevators and also effect on how the staff were coping with this. It was much easier to unload a covered hopper car than a boxcar. So, you just pull this thing over, this hopper car over top of a pit and open the gates and the grain ran out. Whereas with the boxcars, there was this horrendous job of opening the doors and tipping the cars, and it was a labor-intensive thing. And also, the unloading of the cars, of a boxcar, there was a certain amount of grain always spilled and left in the cars. And it was the Canadian Grain Commission's staff that tried to ensure that the cars were completely unloaded so that there was an accurate weight registered by the transfer elevator, because the guy out in the prairies depended on that weight. I mean, he says he shipped so many bushels of wheat, and it gets to the other end and is not the same weight. So that was something that the weighing division had to deal with regularly every day, and we did a fairly good job at that. At least I thought we did. We always had with the number of rail cars unloaded in a day, there was bound to be two or three that there was some reason to complain. But usually we were able to satisfy the complainant in some way or another. Grains got mixed and that sort of thing, but the system worked really well. And then on the other side, when it came to shipping out, especially in Thunder Bay, most of the grain was shipped out of Thunder Bay, and it was shipped to a transfer elevator. And those are the elevators along the lakes and up into the St. Lawrence. And their function was to, as the name indicates, was to house the grain until vessels came from overseas to take the grain away. So that was their purpose. And again, weighing was important because the grain was weighed into a vessel, unloaded at a transfer elevator, say in Montreal or Baie-Comeau or Port-Cartier, and these weights would be registered by the Canadian Grain Commission, and then at some point the grain would be shipped out, and again it would be weighed under the supervision of the Canadian Grain Commission, and those weights would be there would be a certificate issued with our signature on it attesting to the weight. And the inspection division, who I assume you've already interviewed, they would attest to the grade. And that becomes a legal document. So that's why it's important that we really knew what the heck we were doing. Mm-hmm. So, as far as, I have to mention that I came to the Canadian Grain Commission without knowing anything about the grain trade or anything about terminal and transfer elevators, and I was very fortunate and having some excellent mentors. There's a fellow by the name of Roy Wood, who was actually was there when Harold was there.
He's a very good friend of my father's.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we're very good friends. And he was a wonderful mentor. And without him, it would have been very difficult because I had no idea what this whole thing was all about. And there was Jack Riel, who was also an excellent mentor, Ross Teeple in Thunder Bay, Angus Vass. And on the West Coast, we had also very experienced people who came from Thunder Bay. There was one, Jack Gould, and a number of others. But these people were really excellent mentors, and I enjoyed working with them. And it was really terrific. The first, I was there for 21 years, and I got to say, the first 15 years were wonderful. After that,
we won't talk about that. Well, we'll speak about those in terms of challenges later.
You know, challenges, right? Challenges. Yeah. So, and then we also had a staff of scale inspectors, which is much different than what your father had. I think your father and a couple of others tried to handle that, and it was okay while the system was still mechanical. But when we introduced electronics, these are very sensitive beasts that I usually used to curse at every morning. But eventually we got things working well. We had a number of staff. We had a scale inspector in Thunder Bay, another one for the St. Lawrence region, where he was stationed in Montreal, and we had another inspector in Vancouver. And we were able to provide service to the grain trade to ensure that these scales were accurate. By the requirements of the Weights and Measures Act, which is another act that we had to be aware of, the scales needed to be tested once a year. Well, that's fine for somebody who's weighing meat in the butcher shop, but that's really not fine for weighing very large quantities of a very valuable commodity such as grain, particularly when you have somebody on the other end challenging your weight, so we had to be absolutely sure in what we were doing, and that was the reason that I saw fit to put scale inspectors at these locations so we could test these scales as required and on a regular basis. We were testing them at least twice a year, and at any time when we suspected that a scale may not be accurate. So we were able to provide that service to the grain trade, and I'm sure that it was appreciated because nobody likes to be wrong.
No.
Right. So, that's sort of a brief outline of the challenges that we faced. And it was an interesting job.
So I'll just go back a little weeny bit. Mm-hmm. You said you came from Ottawa, and you had been, where were you working before you came to the Board of Grain Commissioners?
With Weights and Measures. Weights and Measures were, they were part of Consumer and Corporate Affairs, and they also maintained a laboratory called the Standards Laboratory, and I was head of they called it Weights and Measures, and I was head of the weight section. So in that section, our responsibility was to ensure the accuracy of those standards of weight, and we worked closely with the National Research Council in order to do that, and provided standards of weights to all of the subsidiary offices of Weights and Measures throughout Canada. There's one here in Winnipeg. There's one in every major city that maintains a full slate of weight standards. Yeah, metric weights, Albert Dupuis weights, and...
So that would be for more than the grain industry? That
oh,
would
more
be
than
for
the grain
everything.
Industry, for everything. For everything. Not only weights, but also standards of measure. So you can, we actually were provided them with standards of measure so they could test gasoline pumps and all sorts of liquid commodities throughout Canada. We even went so far as to, I did some special work such as calibrating pipelines that were used to offload oil coming in from offshore. I did this on the east coast, interesting. Met some very interesting people and had an interesting career.
So taking it even further back, how did you get into that? What's your background?
Oh my, I worked, I think I worked forever. So, how did I get into that? Well, I was working here in the oil industry. We had two, in Winnipeg, we had two oil refineries. And I worked in both of them at one time or another. And I was working as a technologist, and I was also working on the operational side. I was working as a technologist after taking some university training, and before that I was working in the elevators, climbing tanks and measuring what was in the tanks on midnight shift. Delightful, but good for a 19-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I could climb one tank anymore. And we used to, on midnight shift, we'd climb, I don't know how many, but anyway, it was a lot of fun when you're 19. And then after all of that, I was out of work, and for one reason or another, and I went into the post office one day, and I was looking on the board, and there were these jobs posted for the federal government, and one of them was with the Geological Survey of Canada, and another one was for it was a lab in Ottawa that was testing oil products for the armed forces. So I applied for both of them. The reason I applied for the Geological Survey was I had worked for the Geological Survey as a summer student, and I had been up north doing survey work as a junior, another university thing that, you know, in order to, the dog's outside, I'm going to hope and keep him outside. So I applied for that, and lo and behold, and my wife and I were just got married, and lo and behold, I'm offered this job in Calgary to work with the Geological Survey. So off we go to Calgary, and we were there from, this is 1962, from April. And then, lo and behold, along comes a letter from Ottawa saying, you know, you've also won this job with it doesn't matter, in Ottawa with this lab, because I had already done all that lab work. So off we went to Ottawa, and it was with Trade and Commerce. Off we went to Ottawa and worked there for a while until 1972. And then along came this opportunity with the Canadian Grain Commission. My experience kind of just led into that. So it was fine. So we moved, bag and baggage. We didn't have any children, so it was an easy move. So my experience kind of led me into this whole thing. And it was kind of fun. Yeah.
Do you want to just turn it off for a sec? If you.
Yeah. Okay.
So we'll go back to.
Yeah.
The idea of history of why audits came into place.
Okay. The reason for weighing over the grain in the grain elevator, more commonly known as an audit. The reason it's known as an audit because you're actually comparing the physical amount of grain in the elevator to the outstanding paper stocks that are registered by the Canadian Grain Commission. What is a paper stock? Okay, a paper stock is the amount of grain that is taken in by the elevator from any shipment, whether it be by rail or by, in terms of a transfer elevator, by a vessel. That amount is registered by the Canadian Grain Commission. Now, in the terminal elevator system, grain is taken in, the amount is registered, but then during the operation of the elevator, grain can be promoted as far as grade goes. It can go from a 2 red to a 1 red simply by the cleaning and drying or whatever other process they may use. So the amount of outstanding elevator receipts have to be changed. You know, there's a chance to make mistakes there. And also grain could be demoted. In the handling system, you may in some way or another damage the grain and it may be degraded. So elevator receipts or whatever you want to call them, it's a paper stock, that has to be changed. So at some point, and because it's required by the Canada Grain Act, it's required that the actual physical quantity of grain is measured, and those measurements are compared to the outstanding elevator receipts. And that's the reason for an audit. Now, folklore has it, and I never believed this for one minute, that there was some skullduggery going on in the elevators. And I used to hear all sorts of stories about how the elevators would do certain things. And, I can't believe that anybody would go to any great lengths. How much are you going to gain? You know, a ton here and a ton there. I mean, I looked upon it. If there was a discrepancy, we could attribute it to the inaccuracy of the scales, a malfunction of some other instrument, an error in the paper trail, all sorts of other things, mostly by accident. And if the audit was outside of tolerance, we usually could determine the reason for it, and it was usually some good reason. But in years before that, long before my time, there was always this business of, oh, we have to oversee them because they're cheating. I never discovered that. I mean, certainly there were audits that weren't within tolerance, but after an examination of all of the variables, it usually came to the conclusion that the elevator was operating within the terms and conditions of the Canada Grain Act. So I had no reason to suspect our own operation or suspect the operation of the grain elevator. After all, it was the weighing division's responsibility to oversee the weighing of grain coming in and grain going out. But we weren't responsible for what went on in between, mm-hmm. You know, as grain was housed. And, you know, it's impossible to keep your eye on everything. But it was in the elevator's interest to maintain their system within the requirements and the regulations of the Act. Otherwise, their license was in jeopardy, and nobody wanted to face that. So I know all of the, you know, I'm aware of all of these stories that things that went on in the 1940s and 50s and so on.
I don't know what you're asking, so just throw it in.
This is, I think, the first time that the word licenses has come up. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. It's the first time the license has come up. Mm-hmm. I guess you haven't interviewed anybody from that department. Maybe that's something you should do. But anyway, the transfer elevators and the terminal elevators were licensed by the Canadian Grain Commission to operate within the terms and conditions of the Act and regulations. And similarly for the so-called primary elevators or country elevators, they too are licensed by the Canadian Grain Commission, and they have to operate within the terms and conditions of the Act and regulations. And that's a very large aspect of the function of the Canadian Grain Commission. There's a whole section of the Canadian Grain Commission devoted to that. So it would be very worthwhile. Now, I think one of the people that, I've forgotten names, of course, but there are retired employees in Thunder Bay who actually worked for, for the Canadian Grain Commission, and that was part of their duty, was to look after the registration of grain, and also they could speak to the licensing of the terminal and transfer elevators. So there are other people in the commission, which other employees of the commission, which you certainly could contact. Earl Baxter, for years, was in charge of that sort of thing, and I'm not sure. Dennis Kennedy. Dennis Kennedy is somebody you want to talk to, and he is very knowledgeable about that whole aspect because he worked in that. He was director of that section for a number of years. They called it statistics. So he's somebody really that's really worthwhile talking to, and he's fully knowledgeable. That was his area, so he's fully knowledgeable. Should be. I know he is. he's one very bright guy.
Do you know where to find him?
He's probably in the phone book.
Any idea of what part of the city he lives in? Because I have tried to track him down, but there's lots of
communities. Okay. Why don't you leave that for me, and I'll see what I can do.
Well, that would be great. You mentioned in your earlier that your work involved a lot of travel.
Yes.
So could you speak a bit about what that looked like in your job?
Yes. Well, I'm sure you're aware that the Canadian Grain Commission has offices in Thunder Bay, and in Montreal, and also in Vancouver. Vancouver, I would go to regularly because, we had five. We had a number of elevators there, and we also had one at Prince Rupert. So, as being the director of the division, you really had to keep in contact with our people there in order to develop training exercises. Anything new happening, you should bring this to their attention, and. Thunder Bay, I was a regular visitor to Thunder Bay. You had, as a director or as a senior person in the Canadian Grain Commission, it's just not a good management practice that your name be on a piece of paper and nobody knows your face. It's just not a good management practice. And then with Montreal, we had elevators and not only in the city of Montreal, but also in Baie-Comeau and Port-Cartier, and they handle a lot of grain. And it was important that I felt it was important to make make my face known. I became very well known with the people in those two elevators, especially the amount of grain handled by Port-Cartier and Baie-Comeau. The amount of work that was done there, it was very important that we were known. I had one person there, and he would handle both elevators. A difficult job, and also we had the challenge of bilingualism. So that became an issue. Montreal, I had a bilingual staff in Montreal, and at that time they were fairly busy, but I could see the handwriting on the wall. Nobody else really wanted to deal with it, but it was even in the 90s, even in the late 80s, it was time to deal with that situation. That we had a number of people there, and the amount of work they were doing, it really, in my mind, it didn't justify maintaining an office there. But that's the way it was. That's a real, and I'm not sure what the situation is now. Whether they still maintain a presence there or not.
And this is in these two cities?
No, well, in the Eastern Division, we had our office, our main office was in Montreal.
Right.
Quebec City, we also had a small staff there. Quebec City did more handling than they did in Montreal. And then we had Baie-Comeau and Port-Cartier. Okay. And, between all of them, they handled, at that time period, they handled a lot of grain. So that was the reason that we wanted to staff there. But Montreal seemed to be handling less and less of the throughput as each year went on, and I kept on asking the question, you know, why aren't we moving to Quebec City? I mean, why do we keep on, you know, providing a staff in Montreal when the greatest volume of grain is further upstream, further downstream? Anyway, that was my attitude towards it, and it fell. Maybe I was right, maybe I was wrong, but anyway, we didn't do, up to the time I left, nothing was done about it.
And the whole area of bilingualism, certainly people in the Eastern Division would be more likely to be bilingual people, whereas grain went all the way across the country, and I would suspect that there were not a lot of bilingual people in the other parts of the system. Was there any kind of pressure to, or?
Yep, I became bilingual.
Did it?
Yep. No. My staff in Montreal were, every one of them was bilingual. I couldn't get a bilingual person. I had bilingual people in Quebec, at least one. But I had no success with staffing Baie-Comeau or Port-Cartier. I couldn't get anybody to become bilingual and move there. I mean, you know, those are two isolated places. It's fine if you're born and brought up there, but I found the places interesting, but I could see that if you had a young family, it wouldn't be exactly the best situation for a young family. But bilingualism did present its issues. It was required for those of us who had staff in the Eastern Division to be bilingual, because they had to be, you had to give them the opportunity to be supervised in the language of their choice, and also if you were dealing with French-speaking people from the Eastern Division, you had to be able to speak to them in their language. Not that ever occurred more than a few times in my tenure, but anyway. They demanded that I become bilingual, and I said, if you're going to pay for it, I'm going to become bilingual. So that's, I mean, only a fool would not take advantage of free education. So they locked me up for 9 months with a bunch of other students, most of whom were Mounties. So, and I'll tell you, I was 47 years old when this happened, and it was a tough job. It was a tough job. Perseverance, and I got, and this, their method was excellent. You know, I just wish that the public school system would teach languages in that way. You know, not teaching you to speak rather than hammering away at the irregular verbs and regular verbs, and even mention that you just learned to use the language. I found it to be challenging, but I did it. So then every couple of years you were supposed to re-qualify. Well, I re-qualified once, and then thank God I retired.
I guess when I said pressure, I should have said the expectation was on people to become bilingual.
Yeah, you know, really and truly, the requirements to be bilingual in the grain trade, it is really any language that you know is certainly a plus for you personally, but it's not really not required in the Canadian grain industry, because it really operates in English. But that's the government policy, mm-hmm. that thou shalt be bilingual, and we become bilingual at great expense. Mm-hmm. And I don't disagree with bilingualism. I think it's wonderful if the citizens of a country can speak more than one language. After all, look at Europeans.
Oh, I agree.
You know, we're Canadians and Americans. Americans are better off than we were. The great majority, a large number of them, speak Spanish and some form of English, which nobody else can understand.
But you can see where it would provide. It would be some challenges in a workplace, because you were able to make that shift, go in there, learn it, and master it, where you could see people who perhaps left less confident, less education, all of a sudden are faced with the challenge of you really to people feeling threatened for their jobs, feeling like I need to do this, but I don't think I can. So you can see when you introduce something new like that into the system, it can cause some stresses in systemically.
Oh, it's definitely stressful. There's no question about it. But if you want, if you want more opportunities in the public service, mm-hmm. being bilingual is a definite advantage.
Absolutely.
There's no, I don't think anybody would disagree with that.
Yeah.
However, we digress.
So, going on to, you were just speaking about traveling in Canada to the places that the Grain Commission worked, but also I have a sense that you also traveled.
Yeah, international travel. Yeah, I didn't get very much involved with that, but I did make two trips to China, and I made a number of trips to the United States, mostly from a technical nature, to discuss with the Americans on how they were handling grain, and how they were introducing electronic scales. I met with scale manufacturers in the United States. A lot of technical things, which really were kind of more to do with automation than the actual grain trade itself, although it would have an effect on the grain trade, because if we wanted to automate, if the Canadian Grain Commission wanted to automate its function in the transfer elevator system, there would be an investment. There would have to be an investment by the grain trade in partnership with the government, and that really never took off, and not up to the point when I left. However, we could have automated, and it's a good thing we didn't do it, because look what happened. We've only got 6 elevators working, so a large outlay of money, it probably would have paid. But it turns out that with the demise of the industry in the eastern part of the country, who knows? But certainly, automation of our function, of the Canadian Grain Commission's weighing function in Vancouver and Prince Rupert, certainly would pay off. And I don't know whether they've done anything with it or not, but there is. Technology available that would allow you to oversee the operation of the weighing function in the terminal elevator system at arm's length. You could have an office set up in this house and you monitor what's going on in Vancouver. So I wanted to do that. I had money in place in the budget, when the reorganization thing came about and all that, and then I'd have to start all over, and I tried to hire in order to accomplish this I needed a staff of engineers. I needed more expertise, and I actually started to interview people and trying to hire an engineer. They needed somebody with that kind of background. And we had a number of applicants, but anybody that we interviewed couldn't seem to grasp the whole idea. And these were industrial type people who had, one of them, as I recall, now this is going back a long way, but he had some experience in automating some kind of an industry where they did put various electronic devices in certain parts of the plant to ensure the actual handling of commodities, which kind of lended itself into what we were doing. But it didn't seem to be able to grasp a grain elevator. And I said, well, I think if you're going to be considered for this, maybe we could take you through an elevator and you have a get an idea. And he wasn't really interested. So, and then that was too late, because there was a few weeks after that that he came into my office and I decided I had enough. But really and truly, at this, the technology that's available now, you could oversee what's happening.
It's amazing.
From a long distance, you know, given the right kind of desire, you could really do it. We wouldn't have to worry about coffee breaks and sick leave and
transportation costs.
Transportation costs or mood swings or anything else, or you know, some guy has got all of a sudden develops sugar diabetes or whatever, and the next thing you know, he can't work, but you got to pay him. And you know, that really and truly, the most difficult part of a job is, you know, the job of a manager is kind of breaks down into three major components. One is the operation. You know, you got to know that. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is the administration. That's another one. Personnel administration. Personnel administration is a major, major component that takes up a lot of time because, you know, when I started with the Canadian Grain Commission, there were 253 employees under my watch. And holy mackerel, that translates into a million problems each day. So, I recognized that immediately, and I'd never been in that position before. You know, I had supervised people, but these were all very intelligent, technical people who missing a day's work was almost a crime for them. But when I came to this industry, that wasn't the case. So that was something to deal with. I had a very sharp learning curve. And then, of course, not only did we have that, but in personal administration, we had union contracts. Another strange animal for me. You know, I never, you know, to me, you have an employer who's paying your salary, you go to work. You know, I found out different. Anyway, so we had a number of union contracts, and each one of them had to be respected, and that's the way it should be. But I can't say that I enjoyed that. So that was another issue. See, I think in your father's time, he didn't have to deal with that because collective bargaining didn't come in until about 1966, so he had a couple of years of it. But by the time the 70s rolled around, the unions really got rolling, and that was their job, you know. So I have no criticism of them. So, the collective bargaining in government is something that the government managers were having. You know, we were just too green; we just didn't understand it. But now it's different.
We also had such a, as you say, large number of employees geographically spread out so far that would be a challenge in itself. And how to,
right?
Well, you mentioned making sure you showed up so they knew who you were, but there's still a challenge with that wide geographic base.
Yeah, and that's why it was, you know, it was very important to have a senior person on site. You know, we had the women in charge, as it was known in your father's time. Who was in charge, and everybody knew him, and it was the Ross Teeples and people like that who were well respected and run a pretty tight shop. And it was, but after the old guard like Ross retired, then it's a new breed, and the new breed brought along with them, with themselves, the union contracts, and they came up through the union, which in itself is an issue, because they respected more the requirements of the union than they did actually of the person that was employing them. So I always found that to be the sort of a conflict of interest, and of course these are all the issues that I struggled with, and it's one of the reasons that I came into my office that day and I thought, I don't care. So, I mean, everybody reaches a limit, you know. And the way in my work history, you were paid a salary and you did your work. Anyway, and for the most part, for the 99% of our staff, that was their attitude, you know, that was their attitude. But we had the odd person. You know, the odd person who would really upset things, and And of course, you get one person that upsets things, and then it kind of, it's like, you know, it's like introducing the flu. So it can be stressful. But so when it came to, I mean, why do you reorganize? Obviously, you reorganize to save money. So how do you save money? You get rid of staff. And I really wasn't comfortable with that.
And was that something that they expected you to do within your division?
Well, we had already done that. When I came, as I said, we had 253 employees. Due to attrition and changes in operation and so on and so forth, we reduced our staff by at least 30%. So my division had nothing to be ashamed of. We really met the challenges of the times. And we were able to do that because a large number of our employees were part-time and casual. So we were able to accomplish that as elevators gave up their license, we were able to adjust staff accordingly. So, and I'm almost sure that's what happened at Thunder Bay, because here's the guy from Shaw. We had, I would say 50% of our staff in Thunder Bay were casual employees. So that's how we were able to maintain an equilibrium. This guy shouldn't be here.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we'll track him down. All right, ready to go?
Sure. Yeah, the next question, it's a very general one, but if you talk about your career at the Board of Grain Commissioners spanning 21 years, looking back, what are you most proud of that you did in that time?
Oh, I think what I'm most proud of is how we handled the introduction of electronic scales and the introduction of the metric system. I think that was a huge leap for the industry, because not only did it affect the Canadian Grain Commission, but it affected the elevator operation, because I think with our input, the changeover to electronic scales was made much easier for the elevators, and I think that's due to our staff and to the cooperation between the elevators and the Canadian Green Commission, and the way it was handled, I think is a credit to the industry.
And you feel that the people from the Board of Grain Commissioners took a leadership role in that?
I believe we did. Along with the suppliers of the electronic scales, they were more than generous in their time that they devoted to helping us. Well, they didn't need to. I mean, I think our input to them was just as valuable as their input to us. But I think that the elevator people benefited by this dialogue, and certainly. The kind of training, but really, the electronic scales really didn't require very much training to train somebody to use them, because the things were more or less automatic. The early ones, the very early generation of them, were really, there was electronic readout, but the paper, you know, clicked off of a paper receipt, which was really just kind of an adding machine in the early years, and then it got more sophisticated. And I think that our staff, our actual waymen in the elevators, were of great assistance to the elevator staff and vice versa. You know, it was kind of a growing thing. So they helped one another, and I think our input was very valuable.
Were you involved in any way in, obviously, it came down, okay, we're going to go electronic. Did you have input into who was going to be the supplier of that, and how early were you in on the ground floor of that?
Well, basically, I was right in. When I started, they were just coming in. So I was right there. I was right on the ground floor. And the suppliers were really very helpful. Well, they had to be. I mean, they wanted to make a sale, you know. So there was competition, no doubt. But we had no, the Canadian Grain Commission had to be hands-off when it came to making any recommendations about whose scale you should buy or you know, who you should have the job, who should get the job. No, that was, we kept right out of that. That would not be, we didn't want to influence anything one way or the other. That was strictly the elevator's decision on who they were going to buy their equipment from.
There's another question here, and I think you've touched on it somewhat, but it's describing the interconnectedness of the Canadian Grain Commission with other major components of the industry, like the grain companies, the carriers, the rail, water, mm-hmm. the wheat board, researchers, customers, all of that.
Yeah, well, a lot of what you mentioned there is political. I kept right out of... I really kept my direction in what I was doing with my particular expertise. I did have a lot of interaction with grain elevator management at the grain elevators. That's where my job was. I did participate in seminars with the International Grains Institute, SIGI. Canadian International Grains Institute, where I was one of the guest lecturers and maintained a relationship with my counterparts in the grain elevators, such as elevator managers and the likes of that. Some people in the more senior positions in Saskatchewan Wheat Pool and Cargill and places like that, but never, I felt it was in my particular position.
Well done.
Okay, thanks a lot.
No problem.
Okay, and Hampton did the proper supervision?
What's that?
Oh, he doesn't want you to take that.
Nope, I can tell.
Hampers and Hampton supervised, right?
Oh.
Little guilt gifts as I leave for the morning. Okay, we were talking about the interconnectedness, the relationship that the Canadian Grain Commission had with other parts of the industry and the necessity of some of those connections.
Yeah, I sort of remained out of that loop. I mean, I certainly had a strong connection with managers in the elevators, but as far as the grain trade in general here in Winnipeg, I mean, I knew them, I knew the major players, but it wasn't, so it wasn't an avenue that I really pursued. I wasn't interested in that. I wasn't interested in rubbing elbows with the major players here in Winnipeg. Other people, I felt that was a job for others in the Canadian Grain Commission. I had enough to do with my own division rather than having lunch with Dusty Tithridge or something like that. I used to have lunch with Todd Time with somebody, but it was not something that I pursued.
Okay. The next question ties into somewhat when you talked about you had traveled to China, but this question is your sense of the role you and the Canadian Grain Commission played in the Canada's success internationally in the grain trade.
Hmm. Well, I think one of the, well, of course, Canada's reputation for giving honest weights and honest grades is well respected around the world. And I think that that's due, because it's certainly due, a credit to the Canadian Grain Commission for establishing itself in the way it had, developing an inspection process which is second to none, a weighing process which is recognized worldwide as being accurate, and that's one of the reasons, because we give the certificate final, it's one of the reasons that it's a plus for salespeople that are making a deal to sell grain to another country. So it's an excellent bargaining chip. I don't know. For example, the Americans sell their grain based on fair average grade or something like that. I forgot what it is. They also, I don't know whether they provide a certificate final or not. I don't know what their system really is, but they sell an awful lot of grain, and so does Canada. So we're competitive, and as I said, well recognized. And I don't know what the tonnage is. I don't know what the sales are now, but in my time, 30 million tons was not an unusual number. You know, for a country as small as Canada, that's fair trade. So, you know, that's certainly due to the reputation of the Canadian Wheat Board and the Canadian Grain Commission.
Okay. The next section you really have spoken to, which were some of the challenges that the major changes, and you talked about actually coming in. When you came into the industry, you were part of a change process, and that you actually left when there was another change process
right. That
had begun. And you mentioned that one of the things was downsizing near the end was one of the reorganization goals. Were there any other goals that you think they were moving towards when you left?
I have no idea. As I said earlier, I have not had contact with the Canadian Grain Commission since the day I walked out the door. I wasn't angry with anybody. I knew that I was finished.
Yeah, you had done your job. So the next section, because we've covered so much, is significant events. Is there any really significant situation, event, occurrence that happened that stands out for you in the years you were there?
Well,
like a really vivid kind of memory of something.
Yeah. I can say that every day was much like the day before. There wasn't any sort of event that, a eureka of any kind. It was of course kind of the same thing every day, different challenges. There were significant events that happened that we had to, deal with. For example, during the loading of a vessel, and this happened once during the loading of a vessel in Vancouver, one of the scales actually broke one of the load cells. It came down, and they kept on weighing a quantity of grain until somebody woke up that was asleep at the switch, and they said, wait a minute, something's wrong here. So that was a significant event, but that happened once, and we were able to rectify it. It's fortunate that the person I had in charge in Vancouver was a very smart individual, and he was able to determine within reasonable accuracy, within the quantity that went on board, and we wrote a letter covering the incident. I mean, we didn't hide the incident. We wrote a letter covering the incident so that people were aware that this happened. Things like that. And this is the kind of incident that the reason that we have a supervision of weighing in the grain elevator. This is the kind of incident which will happen, and you have to be alert enough to find it and report it. Mm-hmm. So that's really another one of our functions. No system is going to go along without having some breakdown at some time. And if it does, if you find one like that, somebody's lying. it's Murphy's Law. And that did happen. And I don't know of any other incident that might have occurred that wasn't reported, because if we did have an incident that where there was a complaint, we had a complete record of the loading of a vessel with a paper trail of each one of those wings that went to the vessel, each one, and I could actually take this record and have somebody else review it, and I would review it, and we'd say, oh, here's one. We know an incident occurred. So, and that was the reason. That was one of the advantages of having an electronic scale, was it would pump out this printed record, which you could go back to. You didn't have that. Well, with the mechanical scales, you had some two guys standing there, and hour after hour recording these weights, and, you know, sixes became nines, and so on. So, and you know, contrary to the folklore, nobody that I know of intentionally cheated. You know, just there were long hours in the grain elevators, and long, cold, dreary hours. If you've ever been in one, that damn thing never warms up.
True. So,
you know, it just never warms up. It can be 90 degrees outside, and it's cold in the grain elevator. And in the winter, woohoo. So I can speak from my limited experience. In Saskatoon, we were there doing an audit, and it was January. I don't think I've ever been so cold in my life. So, yeah. I got a lot of credit goes to these guys that did this for their whole career.
Wow. Yes.
A tough job. Anyway, so be it.
You mentioned that you did go to China a couple of times.
Yeah.
And what was the purpose of your role in those trips?
Yeah, well, the first time I went, is this the one you have it in? No. The first time I went there to do some training. You know, we were very close to the Chinese. The Canadian Grain Industry was very close with the Chinese, and they were often brought here to the Canadian International Grains Institute, and they invited us to come to China to do a training course there. And there's my students, along with us, me. John O'Connor, who passed away a couple of years ago, just a year ago, and Keith
Tipples?
No, not Keith Tipples. He's from Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, and I asked him to come along to talk about grain handling, which he did. And so here's all of my
students. And what city are you in?
This is in Shanghai, but we were in a number of different cities. And here's my graduating class. They're very proud, you know. Each one of them got a certificate.
I noticed they're all male.
No. They're females. There's another one. Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And these would be, what would their job be then?
These were actually people that were in the supervising the unloading of grain, but it's interesting, they were also military.
Mm-hmm.
So they were unloading grain in places like Shanghai and Beijing, and so they really wanted to know how, you know, come there and tell them how we did things.
So and would some have ended up having inspection type jobs?
Inspection, no, these were strictly people who were doing weighing.
So, that's what I meant. Wave people.
Yeah. I don't know where they ended up, but they certainly appreciated our. Here's another female.
Yeah.
They certainly appreciated our input, and we appreciated our time there.
It's a large class.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so, you say you went twice to do this?
Yeah. No. The first time I went was strictly to do this course, and the second time I went, we were invited to tour some of their installations. We did. And we went to other places in China which we hadn't been to the first time. And here we're entertaining them in Winnipeg. This is part of the Canadian International Grains Institute. And I was one of the people that was escorting them. And here's the leader of the group, Mr. Guo. And actually, we entertained them, my wife and I entertained them right here in this house, a number of them. So,
when you were in China and you went to see their facilities, what were the differences that you saw?
Well, they had begun the installation of some electronic scales, but most of it was mechanical scales. And their unloading systems were, you know, they were more receiving grain than shipping grain. And the one installation that I toured, spent a couple of days at, was in Shanghai, where they were unloading a vessel, and they were unloading it using the vacuum system. They would plunge this vacuum into the grain and suck it out. And of course, that caused a loss of grain. Well, it made a lot of chaff, right? And the chaff disappears, and of course, the weight disappears. Rather than the traditional way that we do here in Canada, was with an elevation leg that's stuck into the grain. It's an endless belt with buckets on it. And that's one way. And then we also have vessels in Canada which are self-unloaders that actually have their own elevation system on the... But that's a whole other discussion. So here we are. And here we are. We're entertaining them here in our house. And that's right here in this living room. So here we are. And this is Tracy. That's my youngest daughter. She was about 10. Hmm. And that's my wife. And you can see we were much younger. And my daughter's a great singer. So she was singing for them.
Oh,
and Mr. Guo, he's also a singer. So we had a piano here. That you can see the piano.
Yeah,
it was there.
Yeah.
And that's now gone over to my daughter's house. And he's singing away. And it was a wonderful evening, I got to tell you.
She looks like she was singing too.
Yeah, she was a translator. And so we were having a good time. And here we are touring the elevators in Thunder Bay. And I don't know which elevator it is right now. That's here in my house. Yep, it's here in the family room. And here, this is on the lake somewhere. And this is inside of one of the grain elevators. And you can see the mechanical system. Mm-hmm. And eventually we get on to, and here we are. Somebody's doing a lecture in one of the rooms. I forget who it is. This is on a vessel, touring a vessel. Shadow Frontenac, and we're obviously in the east, and here we are in front of one of the electronics readouts, and this is in Quebec City. This is in Quebec City, yeah, and you can see they're taking notes. She's translating, and so they had a good time.
Is China still one of our biggest buyers?
As far as I know, you know, I've been away from it. Mm-hmm.
They want to come apart.
Yeah. Yeah, this is at...
Toronto?
No, the Falls. Niagara Falls. Yeah, that... Yeah, but that's a... That's actually a hotel.
See, I'm easy to confuse. Yeah. You could take me to a city,
yeah,
and tell me that's the Toronto,
yeah,
Tower,
no,
and it's
right.
Niagara Falls.
No, this has got a revolving restaurant up there.
So they came to Winnipeg, went to Thunder Bay with you, went,
yeah,
down east with you.
Yeah.
So this was a major investment of their time and yours.
Major investment of our time and their time. But they, you know, they feel that it's important for them to get around and know what other people are doing. And he was one of the leaders of the group. And you always have to make sure you get one photo of the leader of the group by himself.
Okay, you learned
so
the protocol.
There's the other leader. my friend, still friendly with him, and there were the two of them together. In front of the falls. Oh yeah, this is that one, this is where now. This is an important photo from the point of view of how grain is handled. This is at one of the locks. Which one? Anyway, you can see the vessel coming in. Okay.
Up here.
You can see the vessel coming in, and now it has to enter the locks. So the vessels have to be designed so that they can fit into the locks. That's one reason the vessels are long and narrow, so they can fit into the locks. And it was great explaining that to them. And this is carrying grain from Thunder Bay up into probably the St. Lawrence.
So what are the name of the boats that they get transferred to go overseas? They have a special...
Salties. They're salties, but any special their names? It's too long ago. No.
And this would be called a...
That's a lake vessel.
A lake vessel.
Yeah. We get the odd salty coming into Thunder Bay. At least we used to. But it would have to be designed so that it could get through the lock.
Mm-hmm.
And what amazed me, like I had seen it a number of times, but what amazed me was this guy is so far out there, and the navigation has to be so precise that he can get in here. I mean, there was only inches to spare. And they just amazing. And that's some of them taking advantage of the beautiful day.
That's on a boat somewhere.
Yeah, this is on one of the boats. Yeah, I think this is in Vancouver, actually.
Right, I saw a totem pole back here.
Yeah, this is in Vancouver.
So you took them west?
Yeah,
too?
this is in Stanley Park. In Stanley Park. And so we were out west, and we actually went up to Prince Rupert. I don't know. This is in Prince Rupert. No, this is on board. They chartered a vessel for us, and we went out for a little joyride on a vessel. End of story. But I have now all of my other very valuable ones are left on the job.
Nancy will phone and try and find out, because that would be a really good addition to what we hope would be a website almost, where people could look and see some history.
Right. I don't know if I can really do anything with it. I can't.
Well, you can tell us, what are they?
Some of them are family pictures, but a lot of them are pictures of on the job.
Now you have them numbered. Did you very cleverly make a...
Somewhere. Halloween. Well, these are family pictures. These are all family pictures. Oh, here's one. This is one of my Canadian International Grains Institute. Yeah, there's some good stuff on this one.
So perhaps what we should do when we are more into our archiving segment, mm-hmm. and we've got our technical people in line, perhaps we could come back and transfer a few that you think are significant?
I can actually do that for you.
Oh, that's even better. That's great. If you could select the ones that you think would be of significance, that would be really helpful.
You know, I have... my hobby is photography.
Ooh, excellent.
You see those photographs there?
Yes.
That's me.
Okay. Fabulous. because we are really at the ground floor of trying to gather the artifacts, and we're the other type of person we're looking for is we really want to get a website up so that it becomes a living kind of a document for people pretty soon, mm-hmm. and this is the kind of material we need to put on it.
There's an icebreaker at Thunder Bay.
Oh, great. Oh, that's a childhood memory of mine.
Diego.
Wow. That's a great picture.
Yeah.
Really good.
That's Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
That's Thunder Bay.
Yeah, it sure is.
This is West Coast. That's a very good photograph of the kind of buildings that you'd find in Eastern Canada, up in Quebec. Some of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
This is taken here at Kelowna Park.
This? Sorry. Oh, really?
Yeah.
There's a totem pole in Kelowna Park?
There was. I'll show you something. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I should, so we keep the tape part, because I do want to keep going on this. I'm supposed to ask you at the end, are there any other questions that I should have asked that I didn't think of, that you can think of?
Well, we covered everything pretty well. And I think I spoke about my aspirations that I thought I left behind, which was full automation of the job that we were doing, and as I said, I really had no knowledge of what happened after
mm-hmm.
1993.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that, you know, I can't think of anything that right at the moment that we should have talked about. But if I do, I can always
contact
get a hold of you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when we talk about having a grain industry center. And, of course, the dream would be to have one of the elevators, an older elevator, and have that be the center point. Can you think of what would be really, really important for someone to see when they went in there? What, and I'm thinking of general public and also school children, because we want that part of history to be preserved. Can you think of some things that we could do in putting that together?
Well, I would think that It wouldn't be a tough job to set up a mini elevator with hands on, so they could actually elevate the grain and sample the grain, do a mock-up inspection of the grain, have an electronic scale weighing the grain, and have it a system, a mock-up, you know, a miniature system of actually delivering the grain to a vessel. You know, even if it's done on some kind of a flow chart, you know, electronic flow chart, have the grain unloaded, have those rail cars coming into the unloading shed, a mock-up, a thing that somebody could design, and actually have students, whoever wanted to participate, to actually go through the various functions. You know, unloading the car, sampling the car, weighing the car, and doing the inspection of the grain, warehousing the grain, taking it out of the warehouse, getting it ready for shipping, putting it to the vessel. These things are not difficult to build. And if you had that inside
so
of
nice.
Inside of a grain elevator, so let's say the old cargo, well, cargo elevator is still working. I'm not sure a grain elevator is the place to do it.
You and our consultants agree.
Yeah. That's a tough thing, and it's an expensive thing. But you certainly could do what I'm talking about. You certainly could do that at Thunder Bay. It wouldn't be expensive. And it would be a wonderful learning tool. And if you ever want to do it, I'd be more than happy to talk to people about it. I can tell you that.
There we go. That would be wonderful. Because that's what we need, is people with particular interests who can say, I can do this piece. And that's how, you know, Nancy and I are volunteers. We're doing the piece around the oral history. Other people have other skills. and it's just bringing together everyone that's
If anybody ever wants to talk about designing such a thing, I'd be more than happy to participate in sort of a design team. You have a miniature elevator set up. Hey, and you wanted to teach children about, it's a valuable history.
Oh.
I mean, Canada's grew up with the grain industry. So, and you know, you build one, you can build, once you build one, you've got the design, you can build any. And electronic components are cheap.
See, I can't even visualize it, but obviously you can visualize what that would be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know these people that build model trains, and they have them running on tracks? They put grain elevators on the train, little things that they, on the tracks. Well, you just expand that. I mean, you make it 10 times larger or whatever, and you put a proper grain elevator, you know, a mock-up, and have it running. Hey.
That would be wonderful.
I can see that.
The we've done a feasibility study for having a center, and as I mentioned, you agreed with our consultants that that we would feature an elevator as opposed to be located in it, just because of the reasons you've mentioned. And they also said that we should focus, because of we were thinking of Thunder Bay, focus on the science aspect, because there's a missing piece in what's available to young people in Thunder Bay. There is no institution that focuses on science. So they said if you can get the combination of the history of the grain industry along with the science aspects of it, and your comments about the weights and measures is, to me, sort of a science and technology piece. So we might actually contact you even beforehand, because I think if we go out to the industry with the idea and try to raise some of the funds, that we would need even just a verbal mock-up of what is possible, because that's what really stimulates and excites people, is to say, yes, that can be done, yes, that can be done, in your little comment beforehand
you can
inspiring.
With the technology that's available, boy, I just wish it was available in the 80s. Mm. Huh. You know, it's with the technology that's available today.
So did you bring a science background to this job? Like, yeah. You talk like a scientist.
Yeah. Well, I never really did what I should have done. This is not on tape.
Thank you for
your, but it won't be.
Thank you for your interview. Formally, I do want to thank you, because it is a really important information you've given us, and it really will add to what we're doing.
Well, thank you very much for coming to interview me.